The Jeep Grand Cherokee 4xe plug-in hybrid is built for the best of both worlds. For the city buzz, for the call of the wild, for finding solitude, for sharing memories, for day trips, and for far-roaming adventures. Because with gas and electric capability, the Jeep Grand Cherokee 4xe inspires you to explore more, to explore it all. Tap the banner to learn more. Jeep is a registered trademark of FCA US LLC.
Have you ever spotted McDonald's hot, crispy fries right as they're being scooped into the carton? And time just stands still. Ba-da-ba-ba-ba.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America N.A., member FDIC.
What's happened to Paddy?
He's been held up.
Oh, I can't believe it. I was just... Oh, dear.
Oh, well, there he is. All right.
Yeah, that's it. I think I can hear him now.
No vision, Paddy.
No vision. I'm clicking on start video. Clicking.
No, don't click all the time. Just once and let it do it.
If you've got his sound, though, does it matter?
No.
Because I'm taking my vision off because I want to think I'm on the radio in a minute.
But Mike, you are not Paddy Barkley. You're not vision. We know.
Paddy, how do you feel about being pictureless?
Oh, no problem at all. No problem.
Can you see?
All.
Can you see us, Paddy? That's the more important thing.
Yeah. I can see the.
But if I go like that, you know exactly.
I know you. I know you're doing it mentally. Anyway.
Hello, everyone. This is Colin Schindler, along with John Holmes and Patrick Barkley, welcoming you to another edition of Football Ruined My Life. And today we're joined by a man whose age and experience qualifies him instantly to join our table of grumpy old men waxing nostalgically lyrical over the football and the players we remember from the days when you could buy a meat pie at a football ground and still have change from 5 shillings. You couldn't, of course, find any meat in it, which actually, now I think about it, made it quite an expensive piece of pastry. Anyway, the three of us are gathered together to ignore speculation as to the future of the game and to concentrate on the relatively recent past, because this week we are joined by a most familiar and highly welcome voice. It's that of the third in the line of distinguished BBC chief football correspondents, one whose voice brought us accurate and fluent commentaries from football grounds across the world. A very warm welcome then to Football Ruined My Life, to Mike Ingham. Mike, let me start with a question that's always intrigued me. Anyone who has ever tried to commentate at home with the television sound muted knows that it's actually a really difficult job. Did anyone ever teach you how to become an effective football commentator?
No, Colin. As a little kid, I used to do my own imaginary football commentaries, I suppose, sometimes when I was walking home from school, just daydreaming. But I became a commentator by accident, in a sense, because all of my formative years in local radio and then initially the BBC Sport were as a presenter. In fact, at that time, I suppose my long-term goal might have been to have become a future grandstand presenter, if you like. But I didn't do any football commentary at all in local radio. The only football commentary I ever did was hospital radio when I was a student in Birmingham. And then I was just thrown in, surprisingly, in 1984, and I cut so many corners. I really did. I was just presented with the opportunity to do football commentary. So whenever anybody asks me nowadays, how do you become a football commentator? I have to tell them that my story is just almost unique, really.
When you did the commentaries as a schoolboy, did you make crowd noise like this?
Yeah, I did, buddy.
Because I used to do that in my bedroom. Obviously, I didn't go on to become a Mike Ingham. But I used to dream of being Kenneth Wilson, and I made crowd noise like that. And I'm sure my mum thought I had asthma.
I'm not sure that's what she thought, Paddy. I think you're being kind there.
John, John, keep it clean, will you?
I think that the thing about the noise you just made there, though, that was the thing that sort of sucked me into the mystique of football in the first place, because in the 50s, when I was in Plymouth playing a game for the local Wolf Cubs outside Home Park on a Saturday afternoon, that was the sound that I heard coming through the fence. And it just got my imagination working overtime. So couldn't wait to actually then make that step and go into the ground and see it and hear it for myself. I think Eric Cantona mentioned it once. He said, you know, there's no other sound like it, especially in English football, British football, when a goal scored. Yeah. Nothing else like it.
I think when the ball goes in the net, everybody instinctively says goal very loudly. But of course, you don't hear goal. What you hear is this extraordinary roar.
Mm.
And the roar is inimitable. It can only be a football roar. It's different from any other kind of roar.
Yeah, there is no other sound that I can equate it with at all in any other sport. But, you know, in terms of anybody telling me, I suppose once I became a football commentator in the 80s, then I did get a lot of help from two of my favourite broadcasters, Peter Jones and Brian Butler, who I worked with in the sports room. And also Cliff Morgan, the former rugby player who was head of BBC Sport. He gave me quite a lot of advice as well. But no, nobody actually sat me down and just said, this is what you have to do.
You've just mentioned Brian Butler. Is Mention the Drummer a true story?
It is. The two of them complemented each other beautifully, I thought, because Peter was probably the most natural all-round British radio broadcaster there's ever been, because not only could he commentate on football, but he did state occasions, and he just had a wonderful way with words. He was spontaneous. He'd have hated it nowadays. He really would have hated being on air now when he has to be on the air 2 hours before the game, because his commentary was always like a staged theatrical performance. He was ready to go at 3 o'clock or whatever time, 7:45. Yeah. Brian, on the other hand, he had many great skills. Above all, he was a wonderful wordsmith. He used to craft beautiful pieces as a correspondent. And he had that voice that I can still hear in my head today, that wonderful West Country burr. He didn't find commentary quite as natural as Peter. And so he used to have to do a lot more work. Peter didn't used to do any preparation at all, really. He just used to turn up and do the game.
Really?
Brian did quite a lot of preparation and was quite intense as well. He had his head down quite a lot of the time, didn't always see the bigger picture on the field of play like Peter did. And there was one game in Spain, England. And at one point in the game, he was sort of tunnel vision, Brian, you know, trying to focus on the game and everything else. And there was a guy in the crowd beating this massive drum. It's so obvious to everybody, you know, he was walking past the commentary box, I think, you know, waving to the commentators and banging the drum. And John Helm, the football producer, wrote down on a piece of paper, I better tell Brian, you know, to mention the drummer. So he wrote down on the piece of paper, Brian, mention the drummer. So in full flowing commentary, he's saying, and I just have to make up the names, you know, he says, so Lineker passes to Beardsley and now Brian Robson and now mention the drummer.
Oh, I love it.
Brian Butler, of course, originally was a journo, was a writer. He spent quite a reasonable spell on the Leicester Mercury, mid-50s. The only problem Brian had was Brian was terrible with foreign names. He never got the hang of a lot of the either German or Brazilian names, did he, Mike?
No, there was one game. I shouldn't really, I mean, because I love him to bits, Brian. I mean, Brian was probably the biggest influence on my career, on my broadcasting life and everything else. And as I say, he had so many great skills and so much ability. But when it came to the commentary, he wasn't that flexible. And there was one game when England were playing against what used to be the Russian team. They were playing in Kiev. And he wrote down all the names of the Russian players and pinned them on the box. I hadn't realized this. And then in full flowing commentary, he was mentioning every single Russian name. I thought, how's he doing? That's incredible. I don't know who that is. And he was basically just looking at his piece of paper and going through the team, you know, during commentary. What he was saying bore no relation to who actually was in possession of the football. But that's interesting that you say that he was a newspaper guy first. And that really was the apprenticeship for people like, although having said that, Peter Jones was a school teacher and came into it late. Mm. But the way in for people like Brian Moore and Brian Butler, certainly in the 60s, was first of all in newspapers. When we moved on to the 70s and 80s, then the Desmond Lynams and Jim Rosenthal's and all these people came through from local radio. I was in local radio as well. And sparing John's blushes, the thing that always registered with me and resonated with me was when Gary Lineker was starting out post-football into broadcasting. He started in radio. John got him working in radio, which I thought was really crucial because it gave him that wonderful foundation, which you can only get in radio, really. And radio prepares you for spontaneity too, because I remember one of Gary's first broadcasts on radio was in Dublin in 1995. Do you remember that, when the game was abandoned after about 20 minutes?
Yeah.
Now, nobody can prepare you for something like that. And the great broadcasters, the great commentators, have to be able to react on a day like that, as Gary had to. You had to throw away all your paper and all your preparation and then just deal with what's in front of you. So I think those radio days, when I look back, was very sound advice that Gary was given.
Were you tempted to go to television at any point?
Yeah, I was never asked. Virtually everybody I know who's done radio commentary has done television commentary at some point, and I was never asked to do it. Simple as that. So never occurred.
Didn't have a good agent, Mike.
Good face for radio.
Well, there are some people who do much better on radio. I mean, actually, commentators aren't on camera a lot. But for instance, I always thought John Inverdale really, really good on the radio. Somehow or other, his face did not work on camera, and he never got as comfortable when he was on TV as he was on radio. Going back to what you said earlier, to me it was fairly obvious that anyone, especially someone who hadn't had, as Gary hadn't, a sort of secondary education to university level, they needed to gain some experience. And radio's, without being patronising, it's easier. You get a lot more hours on radio. You could experiment more on radio. And it was more relaxed being on radio, in that you can sit there and be pretty relaxed. One of Desmond Lynham's great qualities, I remember going one day and seeing him do a late match of the day. And I was astonished, because there he was on screen, and his top half, he was immaculate. You know, he looked proper. But underneath the desk, he was wearing a grotty old pair of jeans and pair of pumps. He probably did that to relax himself. Is that a fair observation, Mike?
Yeah, and one of the things I get upset about, I get upset by lots of things nowadays in the broadcasting world, but one of the things that I get peeved about is the fact that, and I cannot understand why, you can now push a red button when you're listening to Five Live or BBC Radio and see the studio, see the vision, picking their noses in the studio. You know, the whole essence of radio is to try to appeal to your senses and your imagination and everything else. That's the radio that I grew up listening to in the 50s. So I don't want to see them in the studio, you know.
Couldn't agree more. Interestingly enough, also, switching sports slightly, I think Jonathan Agnew has exactly the same thing. I think he's a superb radio commentator, but either they don't trust him or he feels uncomfortable. In the very few times I've actually seen him on television, it doesn't seem to work. He's brilliant at painting word pictures with the words he uses on the radio. And somehow, if the television does it for him, he's foreshortened. Is that a fair point to make?
I think it is. I think John Murray, I know, who's a very good commentator on the radio, and I like his voice very much, the Geordie accent and everything else. The Geordie accent, but he keeps his English good. This is where there seems to be some collision with. They seem to think now an accent involves talking terrible English, but we'll get to that later. But John Murray always felt that he didn't work on TV and stuck with radio. He's probably right, to be honest.
Well, I think obviously it goes without saying that there is a massive, massive difference between broadcasting football on radio and on television. It's so blindingly obvious. Now, I'm flattered that you've asked me to talk about commentary, but really, I can only speak from my experience about radio. And I think that the general standard of commentary at the moment on radio is still really high in the country, and not only the national radio, but as a season ticket holder, I sit in the press box at Plymouth Argyle and I listen to all the locals commentating away, and they're all doing their stuff and they're all really deeply committed broadcasters. I have real issues though with television, but I have to, all the comments I make about television, I make just as a listener and as a viewer. To be frank, if I'm watching a football game on TV now, going back to the red button thing, I'd like there to be an option to switch the red button and just have the atmosphere only. I don't need sometimes superfluous commentary.
I know everyone thinks he's marvellous, maybe he is, but being a City supporter, I've always found Gary Neville incredibly irritating. So I actually do mute the television screen when he's on. I can't bear listening to his voice. And it works perfectly well. I know it's a terrible thing to say to a commentator, but it works without the commentary if you're actually involved in the game and it's worth watching. It doesn't work as well in radio if you mute the commentator. I have to say that I would agree with that.
My eyes were open, first of all, but I first became aware of the power of radio commentary, I suppose, when my dad took me to the Cup Final in 1964 at Wembley, at West Ham and Preston. And we were standing at the Preston end of the ground, and it was one of the happiest days of my life. And we were with the Preston fans behind the goal. And I noticed after about 5 or 10 minutes, there was one guy doing a little commentary, and he kept on doing this commentary. And eventually I looked at the person that he was with, and the friend with his Preston regalia was just looking up at the sky, and he obviously couldn't see. And so his friend was commentating for him. And that underlined, if you like, the power of that communication, because obviously many of the people that used to listen to our broadcasts on radio, I used to get letters, lots of letters from people who were blind and couldn't see and relied on us.
Yeah.
And sometimes just keeping this to radio, not television, I think what sets apart the radio commentators, and sometimes what can be a bit of a clue that they're not really thinking about what they're doing, is when they just stray away from the basics. And the basics really in radio commentary are, first of all, if you're listening, where's the ball? If you can't tell me where the ball is, I can't follow the game. So you have to, the geography has to be spot on. It's very simple to get the geography right. And the two other things that really sets apart the radio commentator are, first of all, this might seem blindingly obvious, but give the score.
Yes.
If you don't think about it, people are always jumping in the car all Saturday afternoon at some point, you know. And sometimes you can be waiting for 10 minutes to hear what the score is. And the other thing is identify the guy who's sitting with you too. Identify him, tell us who he is, because many times I've listened and I've got no idea who the summariser is.
When they started, Mike, in the sort of 1930s, they used to issue a chart on football matches. And you went from square A3 to B4, and I think that's what Raymond Glendenning did, and they then moved on because they worked out actually you can do it with words.
Yeah, it's very simple, John, because all you need to do is, if I'm commentating and Gary Neville's got the ball, as he's been mentioned already on this, I'll say the ball with Gary Neville, the United right back, near side the right, near side the right, so you know that Manchester United are playing from left to right, you know.
Yeah,
it's as simple as that. It's not rocket science.
I mean, the thing on giving the score is absolutely fundamental. The bit about the pundit, I quite enjoy jumping in halfway through and having a game at guessing and trying to get it right.
The general rule is, if you can't work out, it's probably Stephen Warnock.
He's a client of mine, Paddy, so you can...
But obviously, in television, you don't have to do all that stuff because it's all there in front of you. So that's why I get so cheesed off. A lot of the commentators now just seem to be afraid of silence. They seem to feel they have to fill every single second of the commentary. And I think a lot of it, in many cases, is a bit of a crutch for them as well. I really do think that, because one thing that sets apart football from other sports is I've never been able to understand why there isn't a single former footballer that I can think of who's commentating now. So we get people who perhaps don't really understand the game that much. And if you think about the cricket, Sky's coverage especially, they all played the game. And they all, like Richie Beno, offer something every time they open their mouths. They all enhance your enjoyment of the game. If you think about Steve Cram doing the athletics, think about Andrew Castle doing the tennis. Yes. There are no former footballers commentating, and I think that's really sad.
The one who did try, and who was, I believe, one of the runners-up when the BBC ran a competition for the 66 World Cup, the man who won this prize, which they invited auditions from all over, was a man called Idwell Robling.
Yeah, I remember.
But the runner-up was Ian St. John.
That's right. Yeah.
Who later, of course, went on to be a broadcaster, but not a commentator.
It does raise the question, Mike, about the difference between commentary and summarising. Because when you started, as I remember, there were two commentators and you would swap over after 67 and a half minutes in the second half. So was there also a summariser when there were two commentators?
I was dead against that, Colin, when they scrapped it. I know I was a very lone voice, but again, what really annoyed me was the fact that all the pressure came on radio from television, and with people in television saying, well, why do they need two commentators? We get away with it with one commentator in television, but for the reasons I've already just said, it's a very different demand on a radio commentator. And sometimes you can be on the air for 2 or 3 hours if it's an extra time and penalties job. And then, of course, there's the expectation as well to be on the air for at least an hour before the kickoff. And they never dream on Test Match Special of only having one commentator for that amount of time. And I thought what made Radio 2 and Radio 5 Live distinctive was the fact that we had the two commentators. And that was scrapped. And they didn't really achieve anything from doing it. They didn't save any money. All they did was create an extra seat for maybe a presenter, and that was all. But the summarisers were still part of that package. In fact, you know... This would never happen now, but I remember doing the tragic Heysel Stadium game in 1985 European Cup final, and there were just three people there from BBC Radio, and that was the two commentators, me and Peter Jones, and dear old Emlyn Hughes, you know, that was the setup.
We know what happened inside the stadium, but did you get a sense that there might be trouble on the way to the ground before the match started?
Towards the end of our journey to the ground, as we got closer to the stadium, I had Emlyn Hughes sitting alongside me on the media bus, and there were some characters bashing their heads against the window of the bus and looking at Emlyn. And he said to me then that he thought there could be the potential for trouble that evening. This was my first season commentating. And if you remember, the anticipation for the game was extraordinary because we had probably the best two teams in European football at the time, Liverpool, Juventus. Juventus with Platini and all their stars. And I still think about it now. And in fact, I had such a reaction to it afterwards. I think I got sort of a mild version of post-traumatic stress because I had a pain in my side afterwards because I just simply wasn't prepared for what happened that evening. The stadium wasn't suitable, obviously, for the game. Liverpool had complained beforehand. There was a lot of loose debris lying around. And of course, there was no real segregation inside the stadium either. But we were all geared up for it, just the three of us, no producer. There was no spare body with two commentators and a summariser, no producer at all. So that when all the trouble started, Peter Jones stayed in position for about 4 hours and just described everything that he could see in front of him. And Emlyn Hughes helped him along the way. And I was the only person available to actually go downstairs and just literally count the bodies. I'd never seen a dead body before in my life. And so it was utterly traumatic. And then I'd have to go back upstairs and report what I'd seen. And then eventually, when the game did take place, and it only took place for security reasons, I think, because the logical thing would have been to have called the game off, I had to commentate on my first European final. And I remember just before he handed over to me, Peter Jones said, "All right, we now have a European Cup final to describe. And here's a man to start us off who's been doing lots of different things in the last couple of hours, Mike Ingham." And when he handed over to me, I remember him just grabbing hold of my leg and squeezing it to give me strength, if you like. And because I just felt it was... I couldn't believe, I can't remember anything now about the commentary at all. It just seemed so pointless. Peter never really recovered from Heysel or then Hillsborough 4 years later. And I remember his wife telling me that he had constant nightmares. And of course, he didn't live much longer.
I think he died in the boat race of 1990, didn't he?
Yes, he did. Yes. At the age of only 60, he just retired from the BBC and be given a freelance contract. And he was looking forward to going to Italia 90 and all that, you know, so terrible memories. But great memories of Peter, because the other thing about Peter's performance that day is you can do all your preparation for a match, but when it comes to seeing something, you just have to go with what you see in front of you and throw away any kind of notes you've got and just see and describe everything that unfolds in front of you. He was absolute master that night.
Of course, you don't have to be a football commentator. You have to be a human being with that ability to paint word pictures, don't you? I mean, it's not commentating at all. It's just a terrifying moment that your job is to tell everybody listening who don't have the eyes or the ears other than your voice. There's no training for that. It's just up to you what you are like as a man, I assume.
Yes, it's happened to quite a few of my colleagues too, where they've gone along to a game and suddenly it's gone off at a tangent. For example, I'll never forget David Oates at White Hart Lane when Fabrice Muamba had a cardiac arrest on the pitch and he suddenly had to start talking about that. I remember John Champion when Cantona jumped into the crowd. He had to describe all of that, and so did Jonathan Pearce more recently with Christian Eriksen. But I think if anything, probably looking back at that final, if anything, I probably cut back on all the emotion on the night. You know, what I would have given for a European Cup final normally, I just went through the motions, to be honest, and just tried to tell people where the ball was.
Paddy, were you there that day?
No, it was one of the great strokes of luck of my career. I was in The Guardian at the time, and I was the sort of deputy, the number two to the great David Lacey. And normally I would have gone as the second reporter. To be quite honest, I would have been out of my depth because I had no training as a reporter. And instead, the guy immediately below me in the sort of line of seniority, Charlie Burgess, who remains a friend to this day, Charlie went, and Charlie had much more nous, much more training. Put it this way, I'm glad I wasn't tested, because I think I'd have failed.
The other occasion that springs to mind is David Coleman at the Munich Olympics.
No, yes.
Where Coleman's training and ability was very much to the fore, and he distinguished himself, I think, that day. Anyone who's listening to it will know how well Coleman did commentating on that appalling situation. There are these instances, aren't there, that come along. In my own silly way, I did a bit of broadcasting for a Nottingham radio station, and Forest were, of course, at Hillsborough for their semi-final, and I was sent to do the other semi-final, which was between Everton and Norwich. And as the news came from Hillsborough, thought, what tone have I got to take here? And I was damn glad, of course, like the others of you, that I wasn't at Hillsborough, probably because I got it completely wrong.
I was at Hillsborough, you know, but that was completely different, you know. The only thing in common was that the victims were innocent. Hillsborough haunts me, but I don't want to broaden it because we're talking about Mike's experience.
But interestingly, just what John's story about the other semi-final is interesting, Paddy, because I was at that game. It's a 1-0 win for Everton, and Pat Nevin got the goal, which ostensibly would be one of the greatest days of his career. He's got the goal that's put Everton to the final. You all know Pat, you know what he's like, sensitive soul and very, very well educated. And we went to do the interview afterwards, and he just looked at me and said, to talk about football today is superfluous. He said, I don't want to really talk about my goal or the game. And I just feel everything for the city of Liverpool tonight. It was wonderful. I just give you another example, though. I remember being at home recently. No, not recently, but in the last few years. The Westminster Bridge, the tragedy, the terrorist attack outside the House of Commons, you know. And I remember I was watching CNN live when it had happened. And Wolf Blitzer, who, you know, he's just the number one news anchor in America, probably. And he said, joining us on the phone now from London, we've got an eyewitness, somebody who was on the scene, and he's going to tell us what happened. And it was Alan Parry, the commentator. And they didn't realise how lucky they were, CNN, because very often you can get fairly kind of garbled reports. But of course, Alan Parry, Angus Mackay, the old Sports Report producer, would have been so proud of him that day because he launched into this word-perfect description of everything that happened. So that's the training sometimes that you can get from, particularly from radio broadcasting.
On the back of the terrible events at Heysel, England was banned from European competitions for 5 years or something like that. Were you expecting that, Mike? And did you think that was a fair punishment? And the government's attitude that followed Heysel, was all this a surprise to you, or were you expecting this kind of response?
When I look back now, I thought it was absurd, really. I couldn't quite understand what banning Norwich City, how that was going to help solve the problem. You see, what I couldn't understand at that time was, OK, take the English teams out of Europe, that's fine. But in terms of England football hooligans, the biggest source of that at the time was the national side. That all the problems overseas were being created by the national side. So vested interest, the FA, they kept England playing the World Cup, the European Championship, and the clubs paid the price for it. And then if you remember what happened, so Heysel was 85. They didn't riot in Mexico because basically a lot of those people were cowards. They were never going to riot in places like Brazil or Mexico or South Africa. They picked easy targets. So 88, devastation, European Championship. This is 3 years after Heysel in Germany. Italia 90, carnage earlier on. 92 in Sweden, a disgrace. And so on and so on. 98 in France, appalling. 2000, Belgium and I go on. So meanwhile, all this was following the England team while the clubs were sitting out. And it just seemed to me to be cockeyed.
Well, but it was actually the match at Kenilworth Road, wasn't it? Luton and Millwall, which prompted government intervention. That suddenly football became the bête noire of the Thatcher government, and they did everything they could to corral it. When you think about Stanley Rouse and the Queen in 1966, then you think about the Thatcher government and the FA in 86, 87, 88, that era. Something's happened to football, hasn't it?
Well, the problem was surely that there have only been three prime ministers I've known who've known anything about football. Harold Wilson, Tony Blair, probably through Campbell, and Gordon Brown. And we've never had a Minister of Sport in the Cabinet. Politicians have always been frightened of sport and football, and it's not been accorded proper hearing.
The only thing I would like to interject slightly is when you talk, Colin, about Margaret Thatcher and ID cards, two things I'd like to say. One, Margaret Thatcher was antipathetic towards football, which a majority of people in this country at that time were and still are. And it's something that we perhaps don't understand. And she felt a sense of disgrace. And I felt that. I'm not a Thatcher supporter or a Conservative. I've never voted Conservative in my life, but I felt that sense of disgrace.
Yes, it must have been very difficult for Thatcher to go into meetings of other heads of state in Europe. With this having happened on television the previous night, she must have felt all eyes were on her as if she was somehow responsible. I'm not surprised she felt angry
about
that. That's
right. I'm sure that's true. Yeah, yeah. Mike, is it okay, Colin, if we lighten things a bit?
Because, yes, definitely.
Because we've got Mike here, I would like to know, we've dwelt on a low of his, not a low in terms of his performance, but a low in terms of what it did to him in Hazel. What are the moments that you remember with joy? And there are probably too many, but try and pick a couple.
Well, yes, there were moments, Paddy. There were. The greatest game I probably commentated on in terms of a match turning 360 degrees was the night in Istanbul with Liverpool beating Milan when it was 3-0 to Milan at half-time. Were you there that night?
Yes, I was. I just remember at half-time being with Martin Samuel and a couple of others, and we were racking our brains to find out the record margin of victory in the Champions League final, because we were thinking 5-6.
I remember that night in our commentary team, and very different from Heysel, by the way, when it was just the three of us. Not only do we have Mark Lawrence and summarising, but we had Graham Taylor there. We had John Toshack as well as a guest that night. And I always remember John Toshack was given his sort of 5 minutes to summarise what should happen now. And he put his finger on exactly what Benitez had to do at halftime, you know, to make the change. And the other thing I remember about that night was the Liverpool fans during halftime, 3-0 down. They were singing, "You'll Never Walk Alone," like they do when the teams come out at Anfield at halftime. And that must have got through to the dressing room to lift them all up. Yeah, that was the most amazing turnaround. And in terms of club level, that's the match I probably remember most of all. International level, this is a sort of poignant one, really, in many ways, because it would be Terry Venables' England against Holland, Euro 96. It's the way that I always wanted to see England play that night, because so many times I got disillusioned by watching England. I hated seeing players not being able to produce their club form at international level. But on that night, everything came together. And then, of course, the FA duly rewarded Venables by moving him on. just incredible.
Could they have done that if Gascoigne's studs had actually connected with the ball in front of goal, as he so nearly did? You know, had they won that match against Germany and gone on to win the final, do you think Venables would have withstood the scorn of the FA committees?
I don't think he'd have... I think there was so much acrimony going on behind the scenes that I don't think... Isn't it interesting that we all assume now that in the same way of in Italia 90, I think we think, had they gone through against Argentina, who were in disarray, they'd have won the World Cup. But then that's a wonderful thing about the game, isn't it? All these ifs and surmising about what might have happened. Who knows? England might have lost to the Czechs in the final. But it's great speculation, though.
England, sort of the Rudyard Kipling of the international football. You know, it's all bloody ifs, you know.
The problem, Venables' problems were not on the football pitch. I don't think anyone ever doubted Terry's ability as a football coach. His problem was the business activities he got caught up with outside and his attempt to buy the club and so on, and the Panorama programme and so on, which also cost him, incidentally, it cost him a job in Japan because he was lined up to take the job at Grampus 8, which Gordon Milne ultimately take. Terry's problems were never, it seems to me, to do with football. Terry's problems were his business aspirations or career and so on.
Yeah, but then we end up further on down the road trading Terry for Svenja and Eriksson. And I don't think that was progress at all, to be honest. I thought Glenn Hoddle actually did okay, but I do think that an England manager should have a Euro followed by a World Cup, especially if it's been a successful Euro. But, you know, towards the end, and maybe this is one part why I became slightly disillusioned, because my main job was covering England as the correspondent, and my last three tournaments were 2010, South Africa, where they stank the place out, 2012, Poland-Ukraine, which was a bizarre tournament, and then again in Brazil, where again they stank the place out again. And every single England tournament that I covered, it there was like a ritual. All the players get together and you do all the phony interviews before the tournament starts, you know, 10 days before, and every one of them's trotting out and saying, "Spirit in the camp's great, you know, I've never experienced anything like this before." They got like an Aladdin's cave of toys to play with in the hotel, you know, just about everything that anybody could ever want, all luxury provided. And then the game kicks off, the first game, and they can't keep the ball. And that's the end of it. It was just so soul-destroying in the end.
Yeah. I mean, one thing about England, always had the best hotel, always had the best toys, always had the best VIP activities laid on. And the only thing, as Mike rightly identifies, the only thing they lacked in that period was...
Mike, did you ever talk to Jimmy Armfield about conditions for the England team in Chile in 1962? Because as I remember, they were in some kind of labour camp.
No, I don't think there'd have been too many PlayStations available. You're talking about a completely different era of football. If you think about someone like Jimmy, Colin, and sometimes when I look at the modern day player wearing gloves and think, you know, what have you got? Jimmy actually was playing for Blackpool when he was still doing his national service, you know. So if he was playing away at Portsmouth on a Saturday, he'd have to go and stand on a bridge in his army uniform and wait for the Blackpool team bus to pick him up. Then he'd get changed on the bus into his civvies, you know. So that's the sort of preamble to the making of somebody like Jimmy Arfield. And why he was a one club man, obviously. He was the best fullback in the world at that 1962 World Cup. And in memory, I think I'm right in saying that he also played at left back because they had Don Howe, or they had somebody else played at right back. And Jimmy, for the sake of the team, was prepared to play at left back out of position. And then I remember years later when Graham Taylor was struggling to get a team out in Sweden in 1992, and he lost all of his right backs and ended up having to play midfield players at right back.
Keith Cole of Manchester City played in that terrible 92 tournament. And Keith Cole was the central defender for City playing right back, wasn't he?
He played David Batty at right back in one game. He had Tony DiRigo, who was the understudy to Stuart Pearce. And as long as Stuart Pearce was going to stay fit, that was going to limit Tony DiRigo's international opportunities. And yet he wouldn't move across to the right-hand side. And so I always make that comparison. That's 92, so that's 30 years on from Jimmy Arfield sacrificing his position, yeah.
92, of course, is a seminal year for football. And Mike, as far as you were concerned, what was the impact of the arrival of the Premier League in football?
Well, it sort of coincided with me becoming the football correspondent as well. So I was involved in all of the preliminaries, all of the meetings, and got to know Rick Parry quite well in all the build-up. And I was very amused when he announced that this was going to be a league of opportunity, of equality rather, for everybody, when you look at what's going on now. But the other thing about the Premier League when it was set up, I've still got the blueprint in the attic here, you know, the whole point of that. And I think the FA should have tried to stay a bit more in control of the Premier League, because the whole point of the Premier League was to cut out vested interest and to put England at the top of the pyramid. That was the objective. Everyone was going to pull together for England. You know, that was how it was set up. But what it did for me was that it coincided not only with becoming correspondent, but Five Live, 24 hours news service, many, many more fixtures, much more interest in the game, made it quite difficult for me actually to do both jobs properly. I kind of fell between two stools, between being a commentator and then the necessity of always being in the studio to react to all of the various stories that happen.
Of course, Sky came into the argument at that point. And I think it's also fair to say that Bert Millichip and Graham Kelly were no match for the people who set up the Premier League in terms of negotiating skills. We were meant to reduce the number of clubs, weren't we? We didn't. Mm. It was meant to promote the England team. It didn't. Mm. It's known as the FA Premier League, although I've never heard anyone use that. It's always the Premier League, to be honest. So, you know, you don't get what you deserve in life, I was taught. You get what you negotiate. And the FA just lost control of the argument and got outmaneuvered at every end. And if you look at the personnel involved, I'm afraid that's probably not surprising.
I think the thing that frustrates me now, though, is always this inference, and particularly when I watch Sky, that the history of the game goes back to the beginning of the Premier League.
Yes.
You know, 30 years ago, I was finding it quite difficult when I talked to my boys, my sons, to explain that back in the day when I was supporting them, Plymouth Argyle were in Third Division South, which is quite a difficult concept to grasp, you know. And that Fleetwood and Burton Albion, they were in the First Division. They're in the First Division as they are now. But of course, the First Division pre-Premier League was a very different animal. So I do wince when I hear that the history of the game began in 1993. They're all sort of almost airbrushing all these giants that we used to watch and enjoy from the history books.
That's what this podcast is all about, actually. We all know that football in many ways has improved, but in many ways it's also gone backwards in the sense of community and feeling for your club. A lot of it has diminished. I very much think that the side that people support these days has very, very little to do with where you come from. And I, for one, really miss that.
And the number of games that radio commentators now have to cover is, well, they cover almost everything that's being played. Do you think that's a good idea? Do you think that we've lost something with the sheer number of games that commentators now are forced to cover?
It's not just the radio commentators, Colin. I just think there's a general saturation now of football too that concerns me. They're killing the goose that laid the golden eggs, really, and the way things are going to move forward. If you think about how the next Champions League is going to be restructured, how you think that the World Cup looks obscene with it. It's almost going to be harder not to qualify than to qualify for some of these tournaments. Yeah. The European Championship's going to expand as well. And all that, I'm afraid, is going to be to the detriment of the FA Cup and the League Cup, which will just, I think, vanish. They're disappearing fast now, but I think that they will just cease to be a priority anymore. And what was always great, when I first joined Radio 2 Sport, every football game on the radio was an event. We would have Saturday afternoon sport on two commentary, and then a big European night on a Wednesday. And Peter Jones would come into his own, you know, and the FA Cup was always one of his things too, especially third round. It became a badge of honour for him to get the second half commentary. He'd be sent to a game and it might have been 3-0 at half time, but he'd say, now this opposition will come fighting back in the second half just to sell the game so that he could get on, you know. It was wonderful. But that's what concerns me now. It's the volume, the amount, and it's not special anymore. That's the trouble. They're killing it. They really are.
Or is not necessarily better, you see. The best marketed sport in the world is actually the NFL. Which is a rubbish game, but there aren't many games. And that actually sells it very well. If you look at what's happened to rugby union, far too much. Cricket never stops. We're getting to the stage where every day of the week there are now matches. There are commentators. There used to be three you could remember on TV. John Motson, Barry Davis, and Brian Moore was on ITV. And that was it. Now there's hundreds and hundreds of commentators.
When I think about my childhood going to see Plymouth Argyle, well, one of the wonderful things when I look back about that now is the fact that you've got one shot at seeing the goal. There's no YouTube. You weren't going to see it even on local news on the television. So you had to remember that one goal. And so you'd go away from a game convinced that somebody scored from 45 yards, whereas it was probably just a poke in, you know. But through my child's eyes, that was how I remembered it. And it just helped to create this mystique. Now, players aren't as accessible to the fans as they used to be, but the game is much more accessible in terms of the product that you watch on television.
Very much so. And sometimes when I look at the television schedules and I see that Arsenal are playing Chelsea tonight and Aston Villa against Spurs, and I'm thinking, I never knew about that. Of course, it's a women's match. The televising of women's matches has just sort of added to the sense of glut. Did you ever commentate on a woman's game?
No, that predated me, really. I wouldn't have had a problem doing it. To be honest, actually, I'd have quite enjoyed commentating on the England's women's team. It would give me a bit more pleasure than some of the dross that I had to watch with the men's game. But, you know, when we look forward, though, and I can't see it getting any better, because my own personal view is that we've got one more big television deal that's gone through for the next 4 or 5 years. But ultimately, I think the Premier League will run their own show. I think that's why there are so many overseas owners involved, because they wanted to have Premier League TV. And so what will happen then? Is they'll be in charge of the fixtures. And, you know, if they want to schedule the Newcastle fans to go down to Brentford on a Friday night, then so be it. And they will be in charge of it. I'm absolutely convinced that that will be up and running in about 6 or 7 years from now, Premier League TV. So you'll be having football on 24/7.
Interesting. Football ruined my life has broken a story.
Hey, by the way, football hasn't ruined my life. I can't imagine a life without football and all the friends I've made. It's just not quite the beautiful game that I fell in love with. That's my feeling about that.
I don't know if you would identify with this, Mike, but a few years ago, the Premier League, I think it was, had invited me to a match at Chelsea. No, Sky, actually. Invited me to go to their box. And there was the usual lovely hospitality, champagne, smoked salmon, you name it. No prawn sandwiches, I don't think. But anyway... There was a businessman there, you know, or I don't know what he did, but he said, can you show me where the press box is? And the ground was still empty. It was about an hour before the kickoff. You will know exactly where it is, Mike, at Chelsea, very low down in that main stand. And I said, well, it's over there. It's the seats with the desks in front of him. That's the press box. And he nudged me and he said, I bet your heart's still there. And I looked at the glass of champagne in my left hand and the plate of smoked salmon in my right. I said, you must be bloody joking. I have not missed it one nanosecond.
And that press box also, where you have a worm's eye view of the game, we would be moved there to do commentary on Champions League nights by UEFA, who couldn't give a monkey's about radio. Yep. We'd have to leave our normal position because Kazakhstan television would be broadcasting from that point that night. That's how much they thought about us as well.
Well, on behalf of the listening public, Mike, you know, people remember you so well, I want to say thank you for joining us today. And thank you as ever to John and to Paddy and to our producer who's put it all together for this wonderfully nostalgic and very happy commemoration of times past. We'll do it again next week, everybody. Don't worry about that. But for the moment, thank you all for listening and see you all next time on Football Ruined My Life.
Very good.
Don't tell me you haven't got this recorded.
It was great. Thank you. Thank you for making it so easy for me. I'm a bit out of practice doing this sort of stuff now.